few works with my supervisor in this field, which is Robert Brandenberger, also postdoc in South Africa, Renato Costa, and his supervisor, Armando Weltman. So my main concern with the talk is not really to be really advanced in the research you are doing, but mostly to be sort of pedagogical and self-contained. So hopefully by the end of this talk, I mean, you might be able to know a little bit more about this work, really, as opposed to like just have very advanced results. And so I'm going to try to be very self-contained. My outline is going to be, first, let's just briefly mention why we like and dislike the cosmological model nowadays, the components model, and also comment on the role of inflation. Then we're going to question inflation and address some of the problems that inflation comes along. And that's going to serve the motivation for us to start talking about some quantum gravity theory. For this talk, our quantum gravity theory is going to be string theory. That's going to be my background for studying this cosmology. And in that context, there was a model that was proposed about 30 years, 40 years ago by my supervisor Robert and Kurum Vafa, and it's called string gas cosmology. So I'm going to briefly review some of the main ingredients of that to further motivate a new proposal that came to be about 20 to 30 years ago, which is called double field theory. And then we're going to spend some time there introducing the main ingredients and commenting about them. And finally, discuss about of ODD cosmology, which is the symmetry group of duality. And then we're going to summarize and talk about some future directions in this work. OK, so let's start with our most beautiful snapshot of the sky, which is the CMB. This is from the Planck collaboration 2013. And this really encodes, this picture really encodes the main success of the Lambda CDM model. With only 6 parameters overall, we can actually fit quite well this snapshot of the early universe. And here you see that we have this uniform temperature background with temperature more or less of 2.7 Kelvin and fluctuation of 10 to the minus 5 on top of it. In order to fit it, we use nowadays what we call Lambda CDM model. As I just said, you have only 6 overall parameters to actually tackle all the data that you have available. And among those parameters, the ones that concern to me as someone who is trying to do theoretical cosmology in the very early universe, there are 2. And they are expressed in this quantity that we call power spectrum. Power spectrum is pretty much the way that you fit the snapshot I showed before and encompasses the different sort of strength that different Fourier modes are contributing to that picture. In particular, for the current data that we have, the fits here appear as the amplitude of those different modes, as well as the power with which they contribute to the power spectrum. And we have very precise measurements of those, or actually ways to parameterize those in a way to recover that picture. You have to notice the most important thing for us when you're doing cosmology in the early universe is that this exponent, which is called the spectral index, is very close to 1, meaning that the power spectrum is almost scale in the invariant. It doesn't depend on the scale. And really, one of the objectives of early universe cosmology is to explain or to model a way to recover an almost scale invariant power spectrum. The first proposal that came to be with a way to explain how you can recover this almost scale power spectrum was inflation. And this is back in the early 80s. Different people proposed this model at the time. And really what does inflation is to propose that at some point in the very early universe, there was this phase of very fast accelerated expansion. It does predict almost a scale invariant power spectrum, as I just told you guys. And in particular, it predicts with the correct tilt. So remember that the parameter n, the spectral index, was really close to 1, but was smaller than 1, which meant that the infrared scales have more power than actually the UV scales. And inflation in general predicts a red tilt, as we call it. It's also worth mentioning that in generality for the gravitational wave sector, I mean, we would also have a kind of primordial snapshot of the gravitational waves. And inflation in general also predicts a red tilt, although people can be quite creative in a way that they can also recover some sort of blue tilt. OK, so this was our first proposal back in the 80s to explain that sort of data. And nowadays, still people would argue if inflation should be part of the full concordance model or not. In particular, some of the people who argue against inflation, they argue in face of different problems that inflation faces, either at the level of predictability, a level of theory, or even a level of its own ontology and metaphysics. Among the several issues that we have concerning inflation, the very first one is that we use a scalar field to model inflation, but we know that scalar fields, they're not really abundant in nature, we just know one. And with a scalar field, you pretty much can do any sort of modeling. You don't have any really new information. It's more like a phenomenological approach. Moreover, even if you ignore the problem with the scalar field, then we know that because inflation was really inflating the modes that we had before the inflationary period, it would be the case that some of the modes which are relevant for observations nowadays, they were so small before the beginning of inflation that they were smaller than the Planck length. And therefore, what would justify us to using just normal linear perturbation in GR and just GR equations, classical GR, as opposed to quantum gravity to deal with those modes? And this is called the trans-Planckian problem inflation. We also have, at a more metaphysical level, something that people don't quite like in general, which is eternal inflation in the multiverse. And this comes from the fact that if the inflaton is a scalar field, it would also be a quantum field, and the fluctuations of this field could, in principle, prevent inflation of ever ending. And in particular, there are some papers, particularly from Alan Guth, who tries to address the sort of like, in configuration space, how much of this field has already decayed and the inflation has ended in comparison to the places where inflation would still be happening. And apparently, the measure would be zero. So it'd be very unlikely for us to be in a particular universe where inflation has ended. However, for us, in the context of quantum gravity, really the main problem is singularity. So the standard model of cosmology without inflation is geodesically incomplete towards the past. You reach a singularity. And with inflation, that happens as well. So we don't have a complete picture all the way through to minus infinity in time. And this has been proven in 1904 by the papers of Ward and Willenken. And so one of the main objectives of a quantum gravity theory at the cosmological level would be able to, should be able to address the initial singularity. This is how to say that our standard cosmological model remains incomplete. However, there is a hope, and one of the hopes is that the singularities, they are classical. If we had really the full quantum gravity theory, they should be smart out. For the sake of this talk, and actually for the sake of my whole PhD project, we took as a proxy theory for quantum gravity string theory, but of course there are many proposals, and PI is known to have one of the most important centers for loop quantum gravity. But we are going to keep up with string theory. First question, if you are working with string theory, would be, can we recover normal inflation just out of string theory? And people have studied that and have argued and debated a lot about this. But this year in particular, there has been some heated discussion about the fact that maybe string theory and inflation are not compatible anymore. And this is the papers from Vafa and others. And this is actually a very heated debate in the community right now. For us, this even works better because we actually don't want to do inflation here. We are to do something else. But it's still in the realm of string theory. And what allows us to do that is because string theory brings actually new degrees of freedom and also symmetries and dualities in the picture of the early universe. And we aim to explore that a little bit in the way to do cosmology. OK, so yeah.
I have a question about this. Are you going to come back to this singularity issue? Or?
Yeah, but we can, yeah, depend. You can ask.
I'm just wondering why you would necessarily have a singularity. Like, couldn't I start from some local minimum, which was just, say, De Sitter all the way in the past, and then tunnel, and then have inflation? Like, why do I necessarily have to have a singularity in the past?
Yeah. So I'm not really familiar with the proof in the context of inflation. But it happens to be the case that actually you reach a singularity, even if you have a kind of like quasi-De Sitter initial phase. If you keep going back at some point, it becomes singular. But I'm not really familiar with the proof, and, you know, so maybe. Yes?
Well, this is quasi, it's not exactly.
Yeah.
But also, I think that book in particular relies on, there are some debate about the knowledge condition not being quite right with the they had follow-up papers that they say maybe it's because we know quantum fluctuations, but it is. So how much that proof is robust?
They said it's the same as the classical proof, the condition of generic, generic decision has to be generic, which rules out exact decisions.
I see. So it would rule out being at this sort of, okay, this scenario that I talked about.
Yeah.
That's not generic.
It's hard to imagine who this would be exactly in the stage that we would describe classically by touch.
I think the key point is that it assumed it is like a triple on the world line, assuming that there's always a positive expansion along the world line. But consider if you follow back the physical world line, it expands and then that's attract, it should get your chance.
That's right.
That's how it is. That's totally assumptions number. It's expansion along the world.
Okay.
So it's up to you.
The Borde and Velikin and Guth proof relies on assuming that along at least one world line, the metric was expanding all the way. In De Sitter, it doesn't do that.
It's a default completely, like, if you apply to De Sitter, the proof doesn't apply.
Right.
So I think, in fact, that's the one way to see that, and that's a follow-up proof, right? That's the one with the group. I think that's this is strong,
not
the original one.
Oh, I see.
Okay. You should have that as a separate description.
Okay, so keep going. As I said in the beginning, my idea is to be mostly self-contained, pedagogical. And so really, for people who haven't ever studied string theory, I want to give you like a kind of like full picture of how we get from string theory all the way to cosmology. And we start with a string, literally. So if you have a string in a particular space-time, and what you want to do is now you want to consider the word sheet defined by string, which is the analogous of the word line that a point particle would actually describe in target space. And we know how to write the action of a string in this particular target space. It's given by this particular form. And you see that now we are parameterizing this word sheet defined by the string in terms of the word sheet coordinates. We have a spatial sigma and a temporal tau coordinates. And now the coordinates of space-time, they become just scalar fields defined on the word sheet, given by the capital X here. In principle, now we can start talking about supergravity already, because to that action of the string, which is pretty much the area of the word sheet, we could also have added two other terms. And we could have added those two other terms because they also have the same symmetries that we had with the original action that I wrote in the previous slide for the string. The symmetry is vial symmetry. And the two next terms that you can add is a term that's very similar to the one that we had before, but now with a two form instead. And another term, which is pretty much like a trace, which is a scalar field. And we call this the dilaton. Now, if you consider the three terms together, the previous one plus those two, we can, in fact, compute the energy momentum tensor and see that classically, it's actually equals to zero. However, when you do quantization of the theory, you realize that the trace of the energy momentum tensor is not equal to zero. So you have this symmetry violation when you go to the quantum. And because we want to preserve the symmetry of the classical theory, you can actually impose conditions on those terms so that they disappear. In particular, if you compute the RG flow of this theory, you can define those coefficients that parameterize the deviations from vial invariance at the quantum level. And you can compute them order by order in alpha prime, which is pretty much the tension that defines sort of the mass of the string, analogous of the mass. And what we want to do to recover vial invariance at the quantum level is to impose order by order that those coefficients remain zero. When you do that at the zeroth order in the tension of the string, you recover equations of motion that can be parameterized in terms of one action. And this action is the supergravity action of the bosonic string theory. So that's how you actually start from string theory and can get to some particular low energy limit just to preserve the vial invariance of your theory at the zero order in perturbations. This theory now is much more familiar to us. It has a Ricci here, which corresponds to our typical Einstein-Hilbert action. Also has some kinetic term for the dilaton. And has this particular coefficient or term here for the two form that we also introduced. because now we have a true form and we have a metric field, we have diffeomorphic engaging variance. So those are the symmetries underlying the supergravity low energy limits. And you have the equations of motion, which are just the equations that I showed you before, when you impose that the beta functions of your RG flow remain zero all the way through. Okay, so we have now this theory, and we're gonna actually use this theory to be our setup for starting cosmology. The first thing to understand about this theory is that, yeah?
This isn't like the supergravity.
No, this is pure bosonic. Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, so for this whole talk, everything here is going to be bosonic. So you can see as a sort of almost a toy model to some extent.
Okay,
I mean,
but even like the bosonic content doesn't match up in like arbitrary dimensions, right?
Yeah. So for the sake of the talk, I'm going to be doing sort of critical strength. So effectively, as if you were in D equals 26, which is the critical dimension for bosonic string theory. But you can generalize that or do like non-critical strings in which your number of dimensions would be different than 26.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. There's really no. It's not like you set the fermions to zero. It's just not super gravity.
Yeah. Usually, I guess people call more historically as supergravity or bosonic supergravity or I don't know. Okay. So one of the things important about this theory is that even though we have those symmetries, there is something else that actually comes up, which is called the duality. So string theory has different dualities, and one of them is duality in some sense between the small and the large. I'm going to read this to you. So we understand the duality as a symmetry of string theory relating what we call as winding modes in a compact space with momentum modes in another dual compact space. So here it appears this duality in the sense that when you consider some sort of compact spatial dimensions, not only you have your normal momentum modes propagating there, but also your string can wrap itself around this compact dimension and give you some logical charge, which we call winding in general. A very simple way to understand is to do that in a single compact dimension, and then you can write the string spectrum in this compact dimension, and it has three different terms. So this is pretty much the familiar term that you have with the momentum, which decays as you increase the size of the box. You have now this contribution, which comes from this topological charge of the string wrapping itself around the compact space, what we call winding. And you see that actually it goes with the radius as opposed to one of the radius of the box. And we also have actually new degrees of freedom, which has to do with oscillations of the string. They can go actually to the left or to the right. That's why you have those two different parameters here, N and then tilde. And in this very simple setup, it's easy to see that this meta spectrum of the theory is actually invariant under this transformation. You take the radius to its reciprocal, and you change momentum by winding charge. And so the meta spectrum remains the same. However, we know that this is a symmetry of the, this is a duality of the full theory. So if you're doing scattering amplitudes or any sort of calculation string theory, that's always the case.
I guess that's a conjecture, right?
As far as I know, at the perturbative level has been shown, and I think at non-perturbative level, people still argue about it. Okay, so let's say that we are working with this particular mass spectrum, and we want to do cosmology. For doing cosmology, we usually like to think that the background is defined by the lightest modes, because they can propagate as far as they would like. And in that sense, we can take the m equals zero here to define what would be the degrees of freedom for doing some sort of a cosmological background. And when you do that, you can show that the amount of freedom that you have are encoded by the fields that I showed you before, which was the dilaton, the metric, and this two-form field. Okay, so having that information, we can now review briefly what was the model that was proposed about 30 years ago, and that was called string gas cosmology. So it's a sort of like thermodynamical model in the context of string theory, where you only rely on the new degrees of freedom and symmetries of the theory, since actually back then, but still now, we don't have the full knowledge of how to compute, starting from string theory all the way to cosmology. The idea was that you consider a sort of thermodynamical gas of those closed strings. And when you do so, in principle, you can now write the energy density because you know how the mass spectrum is defined, and quantities like pressure as well. Here you note that if I would write the energy density for a thermodynamical gas of strings, what I do usually, I count the sort of energy states of the string. In this particular case, is the one that I showed you before. But else you have to now define some sort of density of states so that I can sum and compute the full energy density. So this is quite well defined, and we can write this down. And then in principle, we can compute the pressure, thermodynamic pressure for this particular system. However, it turns out that this density of states is really hard to compute. So this is something that should come from the theory. It's something that we compute usually normal thermodynamics when you know the energy states. But in string theory, apparently there are only results for very large boxes. So when the size of your compact dimension is much bigger than the string length. And so even though you can write this formally in terms of pressure, energy density, I can't do anything further than that. So what we do instead is to consider different regimes. Because we know if the box is really, really large, those modes here are going to be the lightest ones. So we expect that if the box is large, there is only momentum degrees of freedom. If the box is really small, then those modes coming from the winding are the ones that are going to be very, very light. So expect that those are the ones actually filling up your gas. And if you are in this kind of self-dual regime where the size of your box is the size of your string length, then you'd have the contributions from all those different modes. When you do that, you can compute what would be the pressure and what's the corresponding energy density. Of course, we don't know precisely how to do the transition between one and the other, but we can model that with a single parameter. In this plot here, we're modeling this transition with this beta parameter. So this beta parameter, in principle, should be sort of telling you how fast you move from sort of a winding regime to a momentum regime in this sort of dynamics as your box is actually increasing in size. And what's interesting here is that we have a sort of duality, because the equation of state when you have only winding modes and equation of state when you have only momentum modes, they are the same apart from this minus sign here. And you can see, so the T duality now is appearing in the equation of state in the way that the equation of state is actually changing from minus to positive in this plot. Okay, so if you take for granted this equation of state that I just showed you and you fix the entropy, in principle, if you compute now the temperature, you can see that the temperature never diverges. So the temperatures find some sort of plateau. This plateau is what we call TH, and TH is called the Hagenauer temperature. And the intuition here is that if you are approaching the string length scale, you have those oscillatory modes that were not radius dependent. And so even though winding momentum modes can be excited and could in principle diverge because the momentum modes goes as 1 over r, those modes now can now flow into the sector of the oscillatory modes and then later on to the winding modes, which would decrease the temperature from the perspective of this r, which is defined the radius of the box. So the idea originally for string gas cosmology was that you have a non-singular cosmology. Of course, this is here purely thermodynamics. I'm not computing any quantities, just showing that the temperature never really diverges in this model as r goes to 0. Okay, so this is pretty cool. It was sort of like one of the very first string theory cosmological proposals. But you saw that I didn't really tell you how the equations look like. And in principle, there is this clear thermodynamical picture, but there isn't really underlying dynamics. And so this model remained as a kinematical proposal, and it still remains. There was like no dynamics accounting for that picture I just described to you. And in particular, just doing supergravity is not enough. You can show that it's supergravity. Doesn't matter what sort of content you have for your matter sector. You will reach some singularities. And so we know the supergravity cannot be the final picture defining the background for implementing this model. So we have to be more creative. In order to be more creative, we can still rely, surprisingly, in the original paper for string gas cosmology. And there they already commented on something that will define our double field theory perspective that's coming right next on the presentation. And the idea is the following. So I just told you that there is this choice between changing momentum and winding modes. However, we know that momentum modes, they have their Fourier conjugate into space-time coordinates. And so if now you can exchange winding in momentum modes, wouldn't that imply that somehow there should be also some corresponding coordinates associated to your whining modes if they are there? And that was already sort of conjectured in the original paper. And this is just to say what I just said in other words, that if you are doing quantum mechanics in a box, you can sort of parameterize your space position, a space vector in terms of your momentum degrees of freedom. But now in this particular theory I just described, you can do the opposite. You could also define some sort of x tilde coordinate, which would be parametrized by the winding modes of your theory. And so in some, to some extent, the quantum mechanics of this closed string in this compact space should be defined by some doubled space in which you have now coordinates associated to your momentum modes, but also some coordinates associated to your for the winding modes. And this is how we can motivate DFT from a very pure physical point of view. However, DFT also has many other motivations. And the underlying idea, roughly speaking, is that the T duality that I showed you before, actually there is a group associated to that, which is the orthogonal group D, D, D being the number of compact dimensions. And so the idea of DFT was initially to somehow build a covariant theory, covariant field theory, in which now your underlying symmetry group is the symmetry group given by T duality. So to some extent, it's almost to T-dualize supergravity in the way that I showed before, becoming a manifest symmetry of your field theory. And there are many papers on that, but I guess the papers that settled the question were from 2005 and 2009, people like Martin Zielbach, Olaf Ohm, Chris Hill. Now let's have a further qualitative understanding. So the idea is that for each of those compact dimensions, in principle, you'd have now double coordinates, accounting for this presence of those winding modes. It's important to mention that if you were doing a second quantization of the string, so if you're doing string field theory, in principle there is no choice of not introducing those double coordinates. Here we are doing this way that we are inferring that they should be there somehow and then building another theory for accounting to that. However, if you're doing full string field theory in the closed sector, people have been arguing that you have no choice. While here for us, we introduce by hand because we are sort of doing a very rough truncation. We are only considering the massless degrees of freedom of the string. Formally, therefore, your coordinate vector would have all sort of like different coordinates corresponding to compact and not compact space. And the ones corresponding to compact space, they would have their duals. And you could also attribute some sort of dual coordinates to the non-compact space, but they wouldn't play a major role in the theory. It's just for having a concise notation. And the idea is that, for instance, if the box is expanding, the radius is becoming very large, all those dual coordinates would be actually, would drop somehow of the theory because now you have only access to your momentum modes. So really, to some extent, to have a more physical picture is really operational in the sense that it depends on the sort of modes that you have available to make the measurements for accounting for what you see in your theory. As I said before, the T-duality group is actually orthogonal n comma n for the number of dimensions. But people who are doing double field theory nowadays, you kind of like lose a bit of this initial interpretation of compact space. And it's more like you define your theory having your underlying group being this orthogonal d comma d, and you start from there. So you don't have to rely on this interpretation of compact space anymore. As I said, degrees of freedom remain being the dilaton, the metric, and the two form. However, of course, this is not written a representation of the OD, comma D group. So you need to somehow regroup those degrees of freedom in a way that they are representations of the symmetry group. And the question is how to do so. Now, simple way to understand how to do so, we can actually just go back to the theory that we had before, that supergravity defined, and just look again to the Hamiltonian and to the conditions that we have to impose on that theory to be consistent. If I had that theory written down as I wrote before, in principle, I could define those different matrices which are now relating the compact sector with, just summarizing the notation with between the compact sector and non-compact sector, and defining this overall matrix here, which is acting only in the compact sector. And when I do that, I can rearrange those terms in a way that there is a new transformation I can implement over this matrix defined only on compact space that remains, that transforms like this, and is still a symmetry of the theory. This is actually called linear fraction transformation. What's interesting of using this notation is that if you go back to the Hamiltonian that we wrote before, kind of the mass spectrum of the theory, now we can write that Hamiltonian in this particular way, where we have this generalized vector, which is combining winding momentum, which is sort of like what we wanted, but this is still in phase space. And then it appears this new curly H, script H here, this particular shape, as being the metric defining the product between those momentum, generalized momentum states. And the second way, the second thing to be noticed is that if we impose what we call level matching condition, and just to give you the intuition, if you have a closed string, in principle, you don't have any particular point of the string that should be preferable. And when you impose that to be the symmetry over your trajectory, over your string, you have that your generators, Virasoro generators L0 and to one side and to the other side, they have to match up. And that imposes this particular constraint on the theory. So if you remember those n and n tilde here, they were your oscillatory modes of the string. And they have to be related with your winding momentum modes like this particular way. So if you impose this condition, you can also rewrite that using now the generalized vectors for momentum that I just wrote down. And then you have this new component that appears here, eta matrix, which is also going to be playing a major role in the FT. So we can understand this curly H and this eta as two different metrics that appear. And they are already in ODD representation in this double space. It's worth mentioning that in principle now you can consider transformations of those generalized vectors by that H matrix, the one that I defined the linear fraction transformation before. And if you impose that the metric is, this eta matrix is invariant under the transformations, you're going to see that this H transformation accounts for group transformations under the orthogonal group. So that's how you, the symmetry of the theory is actually emerging. And going back to the Hamiltonian, you see that for the Mali spectrum also being invariant under those H transformations, this curly H also has to be part of this orthogonal group. Okay, so we have basically all the ingredients, but I still haven't really told you how to represent those things because it happens that you are doing, we have like this ODD group, which is two-dimensional. But I still only have D coordinates in my space. So I haven't really doubled anything so far. And we, so the initial way to think of this is that we go back to those matrices I just defined. In the general theory, they are now going to be not just constant matrices, but they can be actually anything. They become the fundamental field of your theory. So you have this capital, this curly H. It satisfies those transformations, so it looks like a kind of like almost a normal matrix. The dilaton that appears before now can be encoded together with the determinant of the original matrix in the D slice of your geometry, this particular way. And this is actually a ODD scalar. So we have rank 2 ODD object and a scalar to define your degrees of freedom. And one thing that's worth noting here is that this determinant of this generalized metric is always equals to 1. So it doesn't really matter what's happening in your spacetime or your slicing of your spacetime in terms of the G metric. This capital H, which is your fundamental field in this context, is always well defined.
Yeah? I think you mentioned this, but is capital D the space-time dimension or the space dimension?
Yeah, so in what I'm doing here, I'm kind of like forgetting about time, so I'm doing that for all the dimensions. So more towards the end, I'm going to be, for one example, I'm going to be separating time and space. But then for the remaining of the talk, I'm going to actually be doing it all together. And there are important questions about that and we can discuss more. So as I said, the fundamental representation has of OD, D is 2D, but of course I only have D coordinates so far. And that's where, in principle, we can understand why we're doubling things to kind of match up the fundamental representation of OD, D. And that's where we introduce the double coordinates. I don't want to really lose much time with that, just to say that we can think now of this generalized momentum as sort of the Fourier duals of those double coordinates. And if you were to define now transformation similar to what we do in GR, we can actually do in terms of that matrix small h that we wrote down before. In particular, when you consider transformations of this new metric in terms of these matrices, you can recover something which is called Boucher rules in string theory, which kind of like encodes the dual transformation between those fields. Okay, so of course you should now be asking if that's okay. I mean, I'm just introducing coordinates sort of like to make something to happen. But that, as you know, increases a lot in the number of degrees of freedom of the theory. So no, I cannot just do that and leave it like this. I need to impose some sort of constraint that restrains now my 2D geometry to a particular slice, which is going to be D-dimensional. Historically, people start considering this constraint or condition called Sachs condition. And basically, it imposes roughly that this operator has to be, this equation of this operator has to be satisfied for any field of the theory or even any product of fields of your theory. Yes.
So the winding rule, where the winding, for what I understand, is just defined in the dimensions that are compacted by,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
So, and you're defining the, like, the these dual space with all the x tilted i's that are corresponding to the winding. So are you compactifying all the spatial dimensions?
So my understanding is that, kind of historically speaking, that was the original understanding of the theory, that you are doing all of that only to your spatial compact dimension. However, once you have this theory as a field theory in which the underlying group is OD, D, you can actually forget about this original interpretation and just take that as your field theory defining on top of the symmetry group. So that was the original interpretation that can be matched up with what you just said. But once you have the theory, you can forget. You just think as another field theory, which has a different underlying group structure than the one that we have SO1,3, for instance.
So the T dual T can also be extended to the non-compact dimensions in a trivial way. But I mean, it starts with an aesthetic extension, but there is also still the question of whether we can find non-trivial degrees of freedom.
So we have to impose this operation to sort of recover the D-dimensional slicing. And one trivial solution to this is always to say that whatever thing that has dual coordinates, you kill them. And when you kill all the dual coordinates, in principle, you recover the initial bosonic supergravity that we had. And that's called supergravity frame. And we're going to explore that a little bit later. It's worth mentioning, this is more of details. Now you can define in this double geometry some sort of a generalized diffeomorphism, which combines your gauge parameters with your diffeomorphism parameters. You can also define some sort of generalized Lie derivative, which acts very similar to the typical Lie derivative. However, you can see here, for instance, acting on a rank 2 tensor that you have now these two different sort of contributions. So this is not really the typical Lie derivative that we have. But of course, as I said just before, if you take those transformations, for instance, and impose this strong constraint or impose this section condition that you kill the dual coordinates, you recover exactly what we had before, which were the diffeomorphisms and gauge transformations. Okay, so this is just to flash you with the action. So in principle now, you can write something that looks like a nice Hilbert action, sort of like Jordan frame. And this generalized Ricci scalar is written in terms of these new matrices or this generalized metric, and also of your dilaton field. In order to write down this action, you have to impose some conditions, among them that all the terms are up to second order derivatives, as kind of usual. Of course, it has to recover what we call as bosonic supergravity in that particular frame I just defined, and it has to respect the gauge symmetries. When you impose those conditions, you recover exactly each of those coefficients here that are showing up on this Ricci scalar. Okay, so now kind of talking about what was asked before. We have already considered a particular example in one of the papers that we wrote, in which you Now single out time, and let's do that only for the spatial coordinates. And that's also motivated by the original proposal of Robert and Vafa, where that string guess cosmology was on a manifold, which was R cross T9. So in that sense, we single out time, and then you can write what would be the sort of generalized line element. And in cosmology, that would correspond to adding sort of a term for the winding coordinates that couples to the inverse of the scale factor, which appeared all the way before when I talk about the mass spectrum, the way that those different momenta and winding were actually coupling to the size of your box. However, if you consider that and try to do some sort of cosmology, you unfortunately also reach some sort of singularities. You cannot avoid them. They still remain geodesically incomplete. And the question is that, can we do something else still? And to talk about something else, I have to do a small interlude to motivate a bit of what we consider. And the interlude, you'll have to think a little bit, again, operational in terms of clocks and rods. So the idea is that, as we know, we live in space-time, and in principle, all the measurements could be made in terms of clock and a rod. However, we saw before that it's not so easy anymore to define what's a rod, because you have those different quantum operators in terms of winding, for instance. But like here, very heuristically, let's just imagine that if I have some special relativity, I know that in principle to each of my time measurements, I can associate some sort of like spatial measurement as well. However, if the world is really dual, in principle, I can relate my spatial measurement being done by my momentum degrees of freedom to a spatial measurement being done by my winding degrees of freedom. And they are related by the duality as I showed you before. Of course, then I can compare what would be this measurement in terms of my clock, which would be defined by my momentum degrees of freedom. And if you assume that the universe is really dual, there should be also a different sort of special relativity sector completely dual, acting in terms of only winding modes. So when you consider all of that, in principle, you can relate or build some sort of like, quote, winding clock, where you use only winding degrees of freedom to make your clock measurements. And you could be able to relate both. And of course, the question is, does that mean that there will be sort of two times? And the answer is going to be no, but I'm going to be more, I'm going to qualify more this answer later. But first, so let's allow now for having ODD for also the time components of your geometry. When you do that, people have computed the cosmological equations already. So here, those are, if you forget all the terms with prime in this equation or with the tilde, those would be the supergravity cosmological equations in vacuum and without B field. So I have only the dilaton and the metric or the Hubble parameter. But now, because you allow also to have this double time dependence in your equations, you have similar components coming from this dual time. In the presence, so this has been computed a few years ago. What we did, we generalized this to include sort of matter as well. And this was very simple. It's just following the same prescription that someone would add a perfect fluid in a bosonic supergravity background. So we have, okay, we have now those equations. But as I said, for the spatial geometry, I always have to consider some sort of slicing of the geometry to recover the original degrees of freedom. And here it would be the same. It's just that I have now this new convenient parameter called T tilde to address some particular slicing of the geometry. But in the end, I want to have still a slice of those space. Okay, so let's start from what we know. If I take just those equations, standard bosonic supergravity, and include some matter, and they make the dilaton constant, what happens? Well, sorry, first I'm going ahead of myself. So first, let's just take as an example a constant dilaton, because I just want to look to the Hubble parameter really when I'm doing these calculations. And as I said, in the supergravity frame, I should only have this T dependence, just the normal dependence. And when I write equations like that, I can solve them. It's something known since the 90s. And you recover the equation of state corresponding to radiation. So this is really important, and you should bear with me on that. If you take bosonic supergravity, and you fix your dilaton, your matter sector has to be radiation. So if you fix your dilaton in bosonic supergravity, you do not recover GR. And this is very important for us for what's going to come next. So here, I have fixed the dilaton, and I'm just doing normal supergravity. I have a radiation solution. I know how to solve the scale factor and all the scaling of the energy density. So this is all known. But now I can consider the other frame, the one given by the Hilda coordinates. And I can see how that fixes my matter sector. And when you run the calculations, you see that actually the equation state has a minus. But you remember that the minus equation state of the radiation was winding. So without imposing that I had winding in my matter sector, just looking to the geometry, and now in this different frame that's actually emerging, it's still the frame, I do recover the equation state corresponding to having just winding in my matter sector. This is really surprising. In particular, we can solve the equation and see how that precise it comes to be, but it has to do really with a sign that appears in your freedom equation. And so in the end, when you solve that, you have it turns out to be, you have a complex double parameter, you have a complex scale factor. It evolves like radiation in terms of this dual coordinate, but that it has this phase here, this complex phase. And in particular, this phase has a very precise dependence on pi over d. And this was not fixed. So this actually happens dynamically. You can solve those two equations. And I have a slide for that. I'm going to show you later. But it does happen dynamically.
Small a, in the other slide, small a is the scale factor, right?
Mm-hmm.
How, I missed how it became complex.
If you just look to the T-tilde sector, where you take this slicing, this frame that's called winding frame, you have that minus sign that appears in your equations. And so when you have to solve this freedom equation here, either you have to choose that your double parameter is actually complex, or you have energy density is going to be complex. So the interpretation that we have for this at the moment is the following. For the momenta, when you solve, we could also have written a particular complex phase, but it was zero. It wasn't there. So the solution for the momentum is just given by this, and for the wind is given by this. But we knew from the beginning that they should be somehow related, and they are related in a way that should be one being the reciprocal of the other. So if you now relate this to be dual in a reciprocal way, that would be the equivalent of actually relating those two different coordinates, t and t tilde. Now if you remember, you see that t is the sort of duality at the coordinate level, relates t and the inverse of the other dual coordinate, which somehow recovers the heuristic intuition that I gave you before when you thought about operationally having two different sectors of special relativity. So to some extent, it's almost thinking that one of the dual time is sort of like a weak rotation of your original time coordinate. Just to show that this actually happens dynamically. So this phase of the angle recovered in a sort of asymptotic limit for these dual coordinates. And so it's just very interesting that it kind of like starts from zero and evolves all the way to pi over d. Okay, so this is just to summarize that DPD is in quite sort of winding regime. This oscillation of the scale factor tends to stop. And you have really a full time in this imaginary direction of your temporal parameter space. Now we have some, we've been trying to do something else with this. This is still work undergoing. And the idea was that, so as I said before, in the case of the spatial sections, we have to impose a slicing. And the slicing is in principle arbitrary. But here with these results that we have so far, we are saying that maybe one way to think of the slicing in this temporal parameter space is given by what we call this physical clock constraint. So because I don't want to just take different slices and see what's happening. Ideally, what should happen in my theory is that as my box becomes larger or smaller, what I have as degrees of freedom are changing. And so this whole process should be dynamical. This slicing on this space should be actually happening not at my choice, but a sort of like a rotation in this ODD space. And we think that maybe one way to do that, cosmologically speaking, this is emerging from here, but we don't have the framework, and we'll talk more about that towards the end, is to consider that this dual coordinate is related to the reciprocal of the original coordinate. If you do that, it's not hard to see that, of course, if I had this sort of thing in my metric, and now I consider that one of those coordinates should be interpreted as the inverse of the other one, then I can define some sort of physical time which has this particular lapse dependence on the metric. And this would span from minus infinity to infinity. So I wouldn't have to stop at t equals 0. I wouldn't reach a singularity. That would be the hope. And in particular, that's just a simple plot to say that really, even though this t, which is now parametrizing those different times, goes from 0 to infinity, the real t physical, which is defined as a combination of those temporal coordinates, would span from minus infinity to infinity. And if that would be the case, we are trying to recover some sort of, it's a similar picture, in which you have this kind of coordinate r, which parametrizes your slicing in this dual space. But your physical r, which is given the size of your box, is actually sort of bouncing. It never really goes to a singularity. If you impose this sort of duality, or this sort of restriction, or slicing, as the one I just said, at the level of the equations, something funny happens. I don't want to go over much detail here. But what happens that is funny is that you can rewrite those equations with two times that I wrote before, with now just in terms of the physical time. And all the box terms here are terms that, which are new, which will be corrections to the standard bosonic supergravity equation. And what's funny is that whenever you take this time physical now and goes to the asymptotic regimes, all the charge or the densities would actually drop out of your equations, as if when you go to plus or minus infinity in physical time, you would be solving just standard vacuum supergravity equations as opposed to matter.
What is sigma?
Sigma is a very ugly variable that has many components inside. I'm just hiding. I can show you later. So some sort of like ideal picture, very ideal, would be that somehow as you go towards t equals 0, actually you are rotating your frame from this kind of geometrical sector defined by your momentum degrees of freedom to your geometrical sector defined by your winding degrees of freedom. Okay, so just to finalize, to finish, I want to comment briefly on this work that's being done right now. And so we've been calling this ODD cosmological completion. And the idea is the following. So I'm saying that in principle, you should start with your theory. Your fundamental theory now is this ODD field theory defined as the way I defined here. And of course, you can always reduce to one or other frame, and that's totally OK. However, if you don't consider that, what people have been doing since always in the context of bosonic supergravity is that you write your supergravity action, given by this, and then you add some matter, which is minimally coupled only with your gravity sector defined by only your metric. So you see there is no dilaton here. And people have written thousands of papers following this prescription. And so when you change from this Jordan frame to your Einstein frame, naturally appears a lot of couplings here between your matter sector with your dilaton. However, if you now start from your ODD theory in doubled space, and you impose that you include matter in a way that preserves the ODD symmetry of the theory, you would realize that in the supergravity frame, when you kill the tilde coordinates, you have to impose this coupling here with the dilaton, which seems something which is really obvious, but now you can actually show coming through all the way from this DFT or ODD theory. And so there are papers, for instance, like there is a full book from Veneziano or a paper from Veneziano Gasperini, a review on Prigley-Lane cosmology 2002, like almost 250 pages. And all the calculations rely on this setup. And so now there is a room for doing cosmology in this context in which you include this term precisely to account for the ODD completion that should be existent underlying your theory. And what's really nice is that when you do that, and you now go to a cosmological background, you write your equations. There are two new terms which accounts for naturally this kind of like energy density coming from the dilaton. So your there is a kind of an effective T naught, which is pretty much your matter action being derived or varying in relation to the dilaton, in the same way that you vary your action in relation to the metric to write down your energy momentum tensor. And when you take this into account, and now you fix the dilaton to be a constant, you recover precisely the freedom equations of GR for any matter content. So if you remember before, I was telling you that if you fix the dilaton in bosonic supergravity, you only have radiation allowed for your matter content. But now you don't. Now you have all sort of matter that you can just include there. So in principle, that could account for some sort of like mismatch between your way to include matter to your bosonic supergravity and this underlying duality symmetry.
Is that is that just for an effortily background, or do you mean that you can just do a redefinition to G goes to G, speed of 2pi, remove, and don't
Yeah, so you you mean at this term here?
Yes.
This would be for any sort of, but not only for cosmological background. Like your theory would have to be written like this from the very beginning if you want to respect the duality as a symmetry.
I mean, in other words, is it when you write it in that latter form, can you make a field redefinition to just remove
pi
from the theory?
Yeah, so to some extent you're now trying to go to a sort of Eisen frame, I guess. Yeah, so if you do that, that's gonna that this phi is gonna appear in all your covariant derivatives somehow, so we're gonna have interactions, so on and so forth. So like to some extent, people were talking about this way of writing the equation as a sort of a BFP frame. Because now you don't have any more this sort of ambiguity, or I mean you do, but it's not clear how to go from here to a Eisen frame. There is some ambiguity which I don't quite remember. There is like some technical details. But it's not so simple to just redefine the metric here in an ambiguous way. Because the way that you have to define this rho and p, the energy density in the cosmological background, also relies on how you define or how you write down this particular term coupling here. We can talk more about that, but yeah. Okay, so I'm almost over my time. So let me just summary and say a few things about future directions. So as I said in the beginning, okay, our cosmology still needs improvement. We know that. Inflation, we know it's sort of successful. There has been predictions, so on and so forth. But it still has problems that we were arguing about it. If string theory is our fundamental quantum gravity theory, we know that p-duality should be there. It should be implemented in some particular way when you do the low energy limit to define your cosmological background. Maybe the case that double field theory is the way to provide such a description in a concise and precise way. We have some recent results of DFT and extensions. By extensions, it's just because I guess some people who are doing DFT for long would say that DFT is only for compact space and not about time as well. So here, in the sense where I consider like those, all those time coordinates, I would call an extension. But could it result in a non-singular picture of the early universe? Now we know that papers from Loha, for instance, that there is some intrinsic non-commutativity of closed string theory. And in particular, when you write or when you go to target space time, you see that in principle that would mean that your x and x tilde coordinates are actually non-commutative. And in particular, there is some hope, I guess, and we've been discussing about this, that that could help us to elucidate how you do these rotations in this ODD space in a dynamical way, as opposed to just me choosing to take this or that other sort of slicing. If you could ever do that, that would be just really, really, really good, because now you would have this modern theory, which is always well-defined, non-singular, so on and so forth, but really that you have access to different sort of degrees of freedom that makes you to do this rotation in this particular frame defined by the double coordinates. So yeah, so this would be quite a thing, I guess, in this context. That's just to say that there is still a lot of work to do, and this is all at the background level, so all perturbation and so on and so forth, there is much, much work to be done. That's it, thank you.
Well, in time, so there's time for questions. So maybe just very naive when you started with the picture of the CNB and like lambda CDM model. So what do you need to do in order to connect like your work to like observations?
A lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is really, everything here is really far from observation. It's much more. I guess okay. So there's one thing that we could do right away. And this is a project by Olaf Ohm in Germany. We've been chatting about that. And that would be to consider already perturbations at this level. So to write down the DFT action, but not this non-perturbative one that I wrote down, to write down a DFT action for the linear perturbations of your gravity sector. And in principle, that you would allow violations of this sash condition that I told you about, like take this slicing. If you write down your linear equations, you can start like considering perturbations and compute things as power spectrum, for instance, and see if you can recover or what are the conditions to recover a kind of scale invariant power spectrum that would, in principle, account for the initial snapshot of CMB. Honestly, I'm more concerned with the fundamentals of the theory, or things like how to define this slicing or this dynamics. But of course, this DFT theory and DFT cosmology could be, if become successful, could be a full research program on its own. It's really at the beginning. Yeah.
You said you considered solutions with constant dilaton.
Yeah.
Did you get that from solving the equations, or did you put that in?
No, I mean, we imposed that to recover some heuristics and to have like some intuition, because we knew how to handle those solutions in normal boson supergravity. But really what we want is to have everything dynamical. So this is still also like one of the topics to check mark in the future.
But couldn't you solve in a FRW, it shouldn't be that hard to solve just for dilatons time dependence, right? Do you know how those solutions look?
Right, so it really depends on the matter sector then, because I never really define here what's P or rho. So it depends what you want to have as your matter sector. And the solution for the dilaton is going to be dependent on that as well, regardless if you're taking one slicing or the other. However, if you want to be free and to do these solutions in this sort of like P in the tilde parameter space, then it's more complicated because you're solving partial differential equations. So and it's kind of hard to talk about what's going on. So really, I would like to be able to define first how to do those rotations in this 2D spacetime before actually trying to solve the equations. Because I think if solving equations in the way that they are now could be quite misleading.
So you mentioned non-commutativity as a way to rotate the frame, but for example, the supergrade frame is a null submanifold of this eta metric. So is it like there are two ways of rotating the frame, one classically, one like with non-commutative, or are they the same in the other frame?
Honestly, I don't know. I mean, I started learning about this last week. So I really hope that maybe we can come up with different ideas. But for me, what was something that was really interesting from the beginning to learn about this non-commutativity of those coordinates is that they depend only on the string length. So in principle, regardless of the size of your box, your non-commutative relations are still there. There isn't really a kind of like correspondence limit in which you recover a commutative spacetime. And I think that could have some very interesting imprints, even at the level of cosmology. But that's like 1 week old ideas, or at least for me, I know that you guys have been thinking about that for a while.
Any further questions? So if that's not the case, Guilherme will stay here until Friday next week, so you still have time to ask him. So let's thank him again.
Thank you.